Good afternoon. Thanks for hanging in to the end. So on June 2nd, a patient in the Alzheimer unit of a Nebraska long-term care facility developed a fever and cough. He was seen at his primary care provider's office 2 days later, and a day after that, June 5th, he was started on amoxicillin. On June 6th, the local health department was notified that several patients in the Alzheimer's unit had a respiratory illness. And on June 7th, that first patient unexpectedly died. There was a gap in time, and then on June 20th, the local health department was notified that the respiratory disease outbreak had worsened, and 22 patients had been or were ill. There had been 4 deaths, and a patient was currently hospitalized. And at that point, the etiology of the disease was unknown. So Nebraska Department of Health and Human Services was notified, and we launched a joint investigation with the East Central District Health Department and the facility. On June 24th, East Central began nasopharyngeal and oral pharyngeal sampling of facility residents and staff with acute respiratory illness and fever. Samples were also taken from the hospitalized patient. Local physicians were informed of the outbreak and requested to notify ECDHD of suspicious pneumonia cases. On June 28th, the first mycoplasma pneumoniae positive result was received back. Mycoplasma pneumoniae is an atypical bacterial organism that causes a wide spectrum of disease, but generally causes mild disease. It is the most commonly seen in young adults. Outbreaks in group living facilities such as college dorms and military barracks have been reported. Mycoplasma pneumoniae has an incubation period up to 4 weeks, which can make it challenging to investigate, and it seldom causes fatalities. But importantly, it is resistant to beta-lactamases, such as antibiotics such as penicillin and ceftriaxone and amoxicillin would have fallen into that category. All of those do not work against mycoplasma pneumoniae. Now, having identified the probable cause of the outbreak, we refine the case definition, and we call the probable case an acute respiratory infection in a person with an epidemiological link to the facility, such as visitors, staff, residents, or people having contact with one of those people while they were symptomatic, and having a fever equal to or greater than 100.4, or having pneumonia verified on a chest x-ray. We tried to sample all the people meeting the case definition. We determined a confirmed case to be anybody who met the probable case definition and had a positive PCR test for mycoplasma pneumoniae. So among this, we identified 55 people that met our case definition. Among those were 22 staff members. There were 20 residents, 10 of whom were hospitalized, and 7 of whom died. One of the deaths was not one of the hospitalized, though. There was one, the index case was never hospitalized. And then there were others, visitors, family members of staff members who were ill. There were 13 of those. 2 of those individuals were hospitalized, and 1 of those individuals died. So we were finding this to be an unusual outbreak in that we were having more fatalities than you would typically expect. So we wanted, with our sampling, of the 55, we were able to sample 35 of those individuals. Of those, 14 were positive by PCR and 21 were negative by PCR. There was a great deal of community concern. At that point, people were concerned that the outbreak was outside the facility and that there was this big community-wide outbreak going on. So we were getting a lot of calls for sampling. So we did sample 37 people that did not meet the case definition. And when I say we sampled, one very hardworking individual from East Central really did all the work. 5 of the people who did not meet the case definition were positive for mycoplasma pneumoniae, and 32 were negative. Of those 5, 3 did not meet the clinical criteria, which was generally fever, which in retrospect was not unexpected in that elderly, older persons often don't spike a fever when they're ill with pneumonia. And then 2 did not have any epi link to the facility. And we do suspect this just represents a background level of mycoplasma pneumoniae in the summer in the community. There was no evidence of widespread outbreak in the community, and we were able to allay those fears. So to control it, the facility was closed to new admissions pretty much as soon as East Central and we were notified. Ill residents were confined to their rooms, droplet precautions were implemented, and the staff eventually was for illness. We had asked ill members not to work, but they did. So pneumonia is a major cause of mortality and morbidity in older persons. It presents differently than in younger persons. Many antibiotics are not effective, so easy, accurate diagnosis is really important. So it should be planned for, tested for, and infection control put in, and facilities should have contingency plans in place to deal with these sort of outbreaks. So I want to thank all the people that did this along with the co-authors.
So we do have time for a few questions, and while people are thinking of their questions, I would like to ask the presenters to stay here for a few extra minutes in case people have additional questions. And I also would like to give a hand to all of our presenters. Getting things across in 5 minutes is quite a challenge. So if you can please say your name, where you're from, and to whom you are directing your question.
Dirk Haslow, Arkansas State MP. I forget your name, but I was interested in the individual who spoke about highly resistant pseudomonas, two cases within the hospital. I was wondering if there was any work done to exclude some other community epidemiological link between these two individuals. I know one was a traveler, but it's possible that a hospital association wasn't found, but I was wondering if there was potentially an external hospital association.
For the index case or for it to go to our second, the two together, I personally don't think this is very likely. These individuals, their only link was the fact that they both received care at that hospital C. The original patient had a very extensive hospital care and medical care across four different facilities, but the second patient, that was their only connection with any healthcare facility, and we weren't aware of any community association between the two, as the index case was hospitalized for many months before they entered the hospital C.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Sophia Young from Los Angeles County. My question is for Jason.
Jason, can you come up?
Given the fairly egregious infection control practices that you found in the dentist's office, and that you seem to, or he or she seem to make it clear that that is the community standard of care, at least for infection control, does the health department or the board of dentistry have any plans for outreach or prevention activities in these types of settings?
I think that would more fall to the health department. The board of dentistry is, you know, more along the lines. You know, one of the things that we found also that why they wanted to bring outside experts in, the board of dentistry wanted to bring an outside expert in, was because they also, their experts, you know, their oral surgeons on the board of dentistry, you know, weren't sure how serious certain things were. So when they brought outside experts in, an oral surgery expert and then an infection control expert, then they sort of got a sense of how serious things were, and I guess believed us more. I think that would come from the health department. You know, we don't have any plans of now to, you know, go out to these facilities, but it's definitely something that I think, you know, we should focus on in the future. You know, it at least get the word out to maybe dental students. That could be a good way to reach them. The Rutgers University has a dental program, so we can reach them that way.
Hi, Alan Nakashima, Dental Department of Health. A question for the lady that did the MDM presentation. We had a similar outbreak not too long ago, but one of the things that came up was the surveillance cultures that we wanted to collect, but you know those things are pretty expensive. So did you guys pay for that, or it came up that we could charge the patients, but this is not the thing to do either. So just wondering, maybe you know how you handled that.
I'm not exactly sure. I would have to go back and, because it actually never even came up. I think that, if my memory serves me, that the hospital collected them all. They ran the initial cultures and then sent them down to Atlanta. So that never came up as an issue for us. So I'm assuming since they never balked at the money and no patients called us furious, that the hospital probably covered it. But I'd have to go back and get back to you.
I think we're currently on the EIS officer from New Jersey. I have a question for Jason. He actually sits across the cube, across from me. So we've discussed these cases before. And I'll just mention our CSTD fellow colleague encouraged me to do this. So regarding the endocarditis cases, it happened in the dentist's office. And we usually think of endocarditis after oral surgery and it's due to oral flora. Enterococcus is not really part of the oral flora, per se. So suppose these people have gotten wrist surgery at the same place. Do you think the route of infection was, you showed all those contaminated needles and syringes and stuff. So do you think it was coincidental that it happened to be at a dentist's office and that was the procedure they got done and they would have gotten the infection regardless because of the contaminated needles and syringes and things like that? So did it have less to do with oral surgery per se and more to do with the IV sedation?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. There's, enterococcus, especially for bacterial endocarditis, that's not something that you would normally see. And I think that from what we saw when we went into the site visit, from what the Board of Dentistry saw, it was definitely we were more concerned with the injection safety practices and specifically the IV sedation. So, to say that it was probably more due to those practices, which can occur anywhere, it's definitely something that could have been the case. We can't say for sure. We don't have specimens. We don't have like environmental specimens to match for different things. There was literally so many things that they were doing wrong that it was hard to pin down one. But I think if we were to make the case for one, it would be a little more, glaring that their sedation practices were just really bad.
I have one follow-up question, but it's not for you, Jason. It's for the human metapneumovirus discussion. So one of the things was that most of the description we have now is in the inpatient setting for human metapneumovirus. And so one of the recommendations, I think, was to encourage testing in the outpatient setting. But my question would be, as a clinician, if, for example, a three-year-old comes with a low-grade fever and a cough, and they otherwise look well, and you're not going to hospitalize them, should we be testing everybody who comes in with the sniffles and cough for human metapneumovirus just to capture those few cases which might be due to that? That's a pretty large burden on the healthcare system and with in terms of resources and stuff to try to test everybody who may have kind of mild URI just to capture some cases of human metapneumovirus.
So first, I think human metapneumovirus is more common than we think. There were only 5 more cases of RSV than human metapneumovirus in our study, so that was pretty comparable. I would say if we could develop a rapid test for human metapneumovirus, such as like the Quidel RSV and like influenza rapid test, it would be a lot easier to test. It is a big burden to do a PCR on everyone who comes in with a fever.
But as a follow-up, I guess the question would be, even if you test them, the follow-up to that would be, even if you test them and they're positive, does it make any difference in terms of their management anyway? If you test somebody for flu and they're positive, okay, you're going to give them Tamiflu or something, but in an outpatient setting, if somebody's not that sick, will it make a difference in terms of what we're going to do for them, other than just know, okay, this was due to human metapneumovirus, rather than, say, coronavirus or coronavirus or whatever?
I guess I would say greater awareness of viruses leads to different treatment methods. If we know that there's a lot of human metapneumovirus out there, we might be more willing to put money towards developing, treatment options for that. So.
Can I add something to that? It made a difference for enterovirus 268. And I mean, that's not metapneumovirus, but that's ILI, that's not flu. So being able to understand that question If it's not flu, what is it? It's still really valuable, even if there's no clear clinical difference, as clinical differences can arise from that, which is, I think, part of what happened when we saw the discussion between enterovirus 68 and the anthentes. So I think there is a lot of value in understanding this.
Okay, and we are actually over, I'm sorry, but I hope the presenters will stick around, and thank you again, this was a wonderful session.